You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Adif Rafiq, and I'm your host. This episode is the latest in our series on the war in Israel and Palestine. This week, we'll take a deep dive into another one of the major belligerents in this conflict, Hamas. Hamas triggered this current crisis with its attacks in southern Israel on October 7th, in which over 1,000 Israeli civilians were massacred. Several hundred Israeli security personnel were also killed. The brutality of Hamas attacks on civilians resulted in comparisons to ISIS. At the same time, Israel and its allies, including the United States, have called for nothing short of the complete dismantling of the group, just as has been done with ISIS in Syria and Iraq. But how similar is Hamas really to ISIS, and is a total victory over the group possible? Can it truly be eradicated? To answer these questions, we're joined by Yaron Gooning, a professor of Middle Eastern politics at King's College London and author of Hamas in Politics. In this podcast, we're going to take a very comprehensive look at Hamas, both as a political entity and a militant group. This discussion covers a lot of ground. We go deep into the group's ideology, the tug of war between pragmatists and hardliners, and the group's military and political wings. We also discuss how Hamas uses violence, and then finally, we conclude with a discussion on how to hold both states and non-state actors responsible for violence against civilians. Now, before we head to the show, I just want to define two groups that we refer to in the show and then provide a quick update on the conflict. Fatah is the largest political party within the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. Founded by Yasser Arafat, it is now led by Mahmoud Abbas, who's head of the Palestinian Authority, which is seen as a semi-autonomous governing authority for the occupied territories. The Izz ad-Din al-Qassam Brigades refers to the military wing of Hamas. Now, as is our practice, I just wanted to update you all on the human cost of this conflict. We've already mentioned the Israeli fatalities on October 7th, and at the time of the recording of this show, over 9,000 Palestinian civilians have been killed by Israel, according to local authorities. Now, here is my conversation with Yaron Gooning. So, Yaron, let's start with your background. The reason I've brought you on this show is that your book, Hamas in Politics, is very distinct from much of the literature on the group, which largely comes from a counterterrorism perspective. And while those texts have value, some of them simply look like a governmental affidavit attempting to just focus on the group's criminality as opposed to understanding them in their own terms. And our aim here is to analyze, not prosecute, and to determine the motives and future actions of this group. So I think it'll be helpful to first begin by giving our audience a sense of your experience in studying Hamas and the type of sources and methods you rely on and how that may be different from other approaches.
Yeah, I think there's two sort of elements to that. One is the way I approach studying a group like Hamas is very different from sort of the usual terrorism scholarship. I approach it from a social movement theory perspective. So that already means that you're looking at Hamas not just as a militant organization carrying out certain types of violence. You're looking at it as a much broader organization, which has as a political wing, military wing, a social welfare wing, but also which is interacting with a broader social movement, which it both mobilizes and on which it draws, and from which it needs to get popular legitimacy and support. But also, it means that you look at the context of the violence. A lot of analysis of violence that has terroristic elements, if you can take the definition from terrorism studies for that, so the targeting of civilians in particular. A lot of that literature would focus just on the violence itself. And in some ways, by labeling it terrorist, there's a tendency to take the political context away, and it sort of depoliticizes it, and it just turns it into, as you say, a criminal offense, rather than trying to understand where does it come from, how is it affected by sort of the broader political opportunity structure, as one would say within social movement theory, what are the internal organizational dynamics, particularly are there different factions within a movement, and how do these factions change over time, and so the internal balance of power. And then also, I think what's important is that from this perspective, you also consider the impact of state violence. A lot of terrorism studies focuses on the violence of non-state actors and doesn't really consider how state violence itself and so the brutality and the excessiveness of state violence, which is often the case, how that in itself radicalizes populations, etc. And I think another important part of that is that there's a possibility of transformation. So I don't look at Hamas as an intrinsic movement that is sort of as one characteristic. It's something that's changed over time. It draws on a whole array of tactics. Some of them are violent, some of them are not. And I think that changes what kind of sources you look at. So my own research on Hamas started back in the mid-90s when I did my PhD. Key element of that was living in Gaza for 9 months in the late 90s. And so that enabled me to interview both the company, the majority of the leadership of Hamas, the political leadership, but also speak with rank and file Hamas members. I mean, to talk to allies of Hamas and opponents, have firsthand observation of public events, observing the effects of living in Gaza, of the border closures at the time, the economics of de-development, the almost daily killing of Palestinians that continued even at the height of peace process. And I think that has enabled me at the time to get a very good understanding of the factional internal the dynamics. If we, for example, can observe through looking at student elections or having group interviews, it's very interesting seeing the internal dynamic between members and their kind of their leader and how members of talk back to the leader. And I think so since then, I mean, I haven't been able to do field work in Gaza because it's been very difficult since the siege started in 2007 to actually carry out field work. But I think that field work and then sort of following Hamas through the Al-Aqsa Intifada, following the statements of Hamas, but then also keeping sort of an eye on how does this political opportunity structure change over time. And that's something, of course, that you can read about in terms of the kind of the political developments, the rivalry with Fatah, the sort of the main rival of Hamas. What happens to the occupation, what the population is like in terms of the sort of humanitarian the disaster that's been unfolding in Gaza. All these things play into it because you have a broader perspective of looking at this political opportunity structure. And then also, I think one key sort of final element is looking at surveys, at public opinion surveys, because at least gives you a sense of how sort of the general public is thinking about the role of armed struggle, the importance of a two-state solution versus economic development, on all these kind of things. And particularly the surveys carried out by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, which are highly regarded in the field.
And just looking at your footnotes, the footnotes in the book or the endnotes reflect a diverse range of sourcing from first-person interviews to public opinion polling. And I think that's a real marked difference from, let's say, counterterrorism analysts who simply look at an organization from a desk far, far away. It seems like your approach acknowledges Hamas as a dynamic group that operates in a competitive political environment, and it's responsive to some degree to the demands of the public, at least in terms of achieving its own political objectives. And I think another great point you made, and we'll address this at the end of the show, is that violence is very much part of a dialectic. And I think especially in the counterterrorism space, we kind of lack a language to use, a vocabulary to identify, to describe state violence that exceeds the kind of ethical constraints that we impose on non-state actors. And so there is that whole in the counterterrorism discourse where it really privileges state actors. But we'll get to that at the end of the show. So as someone who studied Hamas for so long, did the events of October 7th surprise you? And what, in your view, was Hamas's motivations? How do we make sense of kind of brutality of the violence and the targeting?
I think, first of all, I want to preface what I say by saying that, that my analysis is based on assumptions at the moment, so that are derived from broader changes in the political opportunity structure and also public statements that have been made by both Hamas leaders and some of the leaders of the Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigade, which is the military wing. So it is still, it's very much a work in process. A lot of details, of course, we don't know yet. We don't know what the internal thinking of the military wing is because they don't, on the whole, give interviews. So there's a lot that we will have to sort of piece together afterwards. And so this is very much based on working assumptions. But I think on the one hand, it was a surprise to see the unprecedented extent and nature of the attacks. I mean, Hamas had never sort of planned a breakout from Gaza that would sort of break through this the defense that has been there for years, and then also sort of invade into Israel itself and then attack the Israelis within sort of the state of Israel. That's unprecedented. Also, I think sort of the number of people killed and by all accounts the way they were killed. A lot of that, I think, was an unprecedented escalation. But I think if you look back over the last, well, certainly the last of 16 years since the siege of Gaza began, but also just the last 75 years of occupation, displacement, and then sort of the 56 years of actual occupation of Gaza by Israel, it is not actually that surprising. And I think there are three key reasons that I would point to at this point that could explain the increase in violence and so the shocking nature of the violence that the Qassam Brigade opted for. One is if you look at the situation in the West Bank this year leading up to October 7th, there were already more than 230 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces this year alone. Over 1,000 settler attacks, expansion of settlements, which of course has been going on since the signing of the Oslo Accord in the 1990s, and has accelerated with full support of the government. Then, combined with that sort of threats to the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Jewish activists who want to reclaim it as the Temple Mount, and of course for Hamas this is a big flashpoint because the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. And combined with that, there's the disarray of the Palestinian Authority and of Fatah that has lost a lot of trust from many, many Palestinians for the way it is sort of seen as having become the sort of the police officer of Israel to come to keep the calm in the occupied West Bank, and the lack of that public support. And I think if you combine these things, you can see that there's both a sense of urgency that the West Bank is there's an onslaught on the West Bank. There's talk of annexation by a number of ministers in the Netanyahu government. So one reason would be for Hamas to show solidarity with the West Bank, to also to claim leadership of the Palestinian movement and particularly leadership of the resistance again. And I think what's interesting, if you look at opinion polls, that support for a return to armed uprising in the West Bank specifically has risen this last year from 35% to 54%. So one calculation, I'm assuming, would have been that a violent and shocking attack would lead to protests in the West Bank, but also the response, of course, and that Israel would towards Gaza would lead to protests in the West Bank and then possibly an uprising. So that's, I think, one element. The other element is Gaza itself, the sort of the blockade, the inhumane living conditions. I mean, already in the mid-2010s, the UN and various other international organizations declared that life in Gaza would be unbearable by 2020. And here, now in 2023, 80% of Gazans are dependent on humanitarian aid and live under the poverty line. There's a sense that this small enclave is being forgotten, so forced to accept an untenable status quo, and somewhere that Israel has come to believe that it can just continue with this blockade and this occupation without paying any price, and that has to be also seen in terms of the attempts that Hamas has carried out over the last 16 years to try and end the blockade. There have been a number of more limited wars, where Hamas would launch rockets, but not this kind of this ground invasion. For example, the 2012 and 2014 wars were very explicitly linked to ending the blockade, and Hamas was trying to use its continued violence as a leverage over Israel. Those failed. Then there have been numerous political overtures from 2007 onwards, when Hamas agreed implicitly to a two-state solution by entering a national unity government with Fatah on the basis of a state, a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. And all the way through the 2010s, repeated attempts at national unity governments with Fatah, where Hamas would try and meet some of the conditions of the international community by, for example, putting forward only technocrats and not Hamas members to try and get this government accepted by the international community, issuing a manifesto in 2017 where they explicitly state in their own document that they would accept a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. So there have been political overtures, and they haven't worked. And I think this has meant that internally, both the kind of the hardliners within Hamas would have regained the upper hand by the late 2010s, but also the more pragmatic parts of the political leadership would have then conceded that what they were doing was not working. And it's interesting, one of the leaders of the political bureau of Hamas, Abu Marzouk, he was interviewed recently after the October 7 events, and I think what he said encapsulates this. He said, we rolled down all of the pathways to get some of our rights. We knocked on the door of reconciliation. We weren't allowed in. This is focusing on Fatah. We knocked on the door of elections, and we were deprived of them. This refers to the 2020 elections that President Abbas abandoned because he feared he would lose them to Hamas. We knocked on the door of a political document for the whole world, but they didn't let us in. We tried every path. We didn't find one political path to take us out of this morass and free us from occupation. So I think that shows us of the desperate condition that the political leadership sort of sees. And then I think the final element is the regional and international situation. Firstly, you have the most right-wing government in Israel's history, which is really talking about annexation of the West Bank, has not made any meaningful moves on the Palestinian state for years. And then has been pursuing normalization agreements in the Arab world with Arab states, which were not predicated on having first established a Palestinian state. And I think particularly the rumors that Saudi Arabia was close to such an agreement would have pushed the Hamas leadership into thinking, if we don't do anything now, there will not be any Palestinian state option left. There will not be any Palestinian question left, because we will just be forgotten. There won't be any pressure from Arab states for a Palestinian state. The West Bank will be annexed, and then just this one enclave on 1% of what was British mandate Palestine historically, 1% in Gaza would be left. And so I think that sort of, for me, explains the kind of the desperation behind this attack.
Yeah. So it seems that, and I think you've brought some broader context to this as well. Historically, it looks like the group uses violence to achieve political ends. So one can condemn the attacks on civilians and the nature of those attacks as well, there are political motives behind it, and it's context driven. Now, I'm wondering, what is the best way to look at Hamas? Because there's a terrorist label on it, but and you commented on these divisions. I'm not sure if they continue to exist between hardliners and moderates, and between the political wing and the militant wing. So is this an organization that is a political movement with a militant wing, or is it a militant organization with a political front? And are these distinctions important in our analysis?
I certainly think that these distinctions are important. I think how you would characterize it changes over time. First of all, Hamas emerged out of a movement which was focused on social welfare and had started participating in union elections in the 1980s. So the military wing was an addition to that. Then, of course, Hamas eclipsed the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, out of which it emerged and became the main sort of political Islamist party. But I think for large parts of its history, it was a political party which had social welfare and military wings. Then over time, that balance has shifted. So there were periods when the military wing seemed to call the shots, and there were other periods when the political wing seemed to call the shots. Now, that's maybe sort of overstating it, because, of course, Hamas is also it is an organization which has a decision-making structure which seeks to come to reach decisions by consent. And so there will be representatives from all these different factions and wings on that body, the Shura Council. But I think it's still important to recognize that the people on the Shura Council represent different interests and different factions. And I think what my past research has suggested, and I think it's still valid, is that if the political opportunity structure changes, then the internal balance of power within Hamas changes. And so it's very interesting, for example, if you look at the 2005-2006 elections, municipal and national elections, in which Hamas was encouraged to participate by the international community, there was a clear sense in which the political leadership was in the ascendancy, the military leadership was in crisis. This was sort of the end of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, the military leadership had failed to I mean, they had promised a bit of revenge for the assassinations of two main leaders of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and Abdelaziz Ramtisi, who were both killed by Israel in 2004. And the Qassam brigades had promised streets of blood in very, very graphic terms. And on the whole, Israel had managed to thwart those attacks, often already knowing beforehand when the attack would take place, and then stopping it from happening. So there was a kind of crisis in the military wing. The political wing saw an opportunity, because they said there are now elections. We can convert our the popularity we've gained by being a military force and a resistance movement, which was very popular during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. We can convert that into political power, and that meant that the political wing could convince the military wing to agree to a ceasefire, which happened in 2005 with the Cairo declaration. But then what's interesting is that Hamas wins the elections in 2006, to the surprise of everyone, I think, including Hamas. I think they were going for making a good show and being a strong opposition, but not actually winning the elections, but they won the elections. Instead of then accepting those elections, which were considered by international observers mostly free and fair, the international community, as well as Fatah and Israel, boycotted this new government. And so that meant that the political opportunity structure drastically changed. Having first been promised the possibility of political power, suddenly Hamas was running a government that had very little power, because Fatah had called on all its supporters within the civil service to boycott the Hamas government. So although they had the ministries, they didn't have the people to carry out what they wanted to do. And that meant that in that year after the elections, the political leadership lost a lot of ground internally, and the military leadership then regained influence. So for example, the 2006 war, which followed the kidnapping of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, which was by the military wing, that shows again that the military wing was again on the ascendancy. And then when eventually, after a national unity government with Fatah failed in 2007, and more and more clashes were happening between Fatah and Hamas, the military wing, as far as we know, then led the violent ouster of Fatah from Gaza, after they had received intelligence that Fatah was planning a coup against them to try and oust Hamas. But that very brutal, violent ouster of Fatah was led by the Qassam brigades. And as far as we know, some of the political leadership were not happy with the extent of the violence, but also with the effect of it, because that meant that Gaza suddenly became a separate enclave from the West Bank. Hamas lost its control of the West Bank, and then that sort of set in motion this division between Gaza and West Bank, one ruled by Hamas and one by Fatah. But so I think that shows how changes in the political opportunity structure affect this internal balance of power. And I think what happened in the last 5 years, since the manifesto in 2017 that the political leadership issued, and they would have issued it with the consent of the military wing, because otherwise they wouldn't have been allowed to issue it. And then also the Great March of Return, I think, is a very important pivot point here, where this was an independent movement of grassroots Gazan activists who wanted, through nonviolent means, to end the blockade by marching on the border and just continuing that until Israel would concede to opening the border. Hamas co-opted that movement, but for a large part of its the actual activists remained nonviolent. You can see this from B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights organization, which documents online each death and the circumstance of that death. And you can see that the majority of those killed by the Israeli army were people who had not violently engaged the Israeli army. So it was interesting that although Hamas was there under a hardline leadership of Yahya Sinwar, who'd been elected that year as well, 2017, that it went along with this great march of return. There was some violence, which it was responsible for, but it also endorsed this more popular protest. So I think that was a turning point, because that didn't work. So even nonviolent resistance didn't work. And then when the 2020 elections were scheduled, President Abbas cancelled them because he feared losing them. I think that was also a turning point for the internal power struggle within Hamas, where the political leadership then also conceded that, but there's nothing we can do. There's no political outlook anymore. And that then gave the military leadership a chance to plan this attack.
And I want to go deeper into that question, into the issue of Hamas's sort of political agenda or its political program. Because when we've heard in the past this month, many comparisons between Hamas and ISIS. And, you know, in terms of the spectacle of the violence, you know, there may be some similarities. But when I read your book and I look at sort of the political theory behind the organization, within the spectrum of Islamist organizations and Islamist movements, this is a group that at least theoretically has embraced the idea of democracy and in some ways popular consent. And it's far deeper along the spectrum of groups that have reconciled with these contemporary or modern notions of political rule. So I'd like you to unpack the differences in terms of the political agendas between the groups, or, you know, if you'd like, just sort of go deeper into how Hamas looks at democracy and political rule.
I think you put two really important difference here between ISIS and Hamas, and that is, as you said, the endorsement of democracy. Now, of course, when I interviewed Hamas leadership and asked them about their kind of their political theory, that is the thinking behind the organization, this was before they had come to power. And I think since coming to power, they have certainly in practice become much more autocratic than what they said in theory beforehand. So there are some caveats there. But I think it is crucial that within Hamas's own thinking, they see the democracy as an Islamic invention. You can dispute this, but the way they interpreted sort of early Islamic politics, they pointed to a number of consensual features, and where sort of early Muslim leaders would consult tribes or leaders of the tribes, and so they interpret that as the kind of the forerunner of a democratic system where a political party to rule and a government to rule, it needs to have the consent of the population, and without that consent, it doesn't have that legitimacy. And so it's very interesting when you talk then to Hamas leaders about, for example, the role of Islamic law, of Sharia law, that they said very very clearly that Sharia law is law that's been revealed, but it's not legal. It doesn't have legal purchase in the country until it has been legislated on by an elected legislative chamber. So. And I think the reason why they had that in there is that they felt that what was revealed back in the 7th century is not necessarily applicable in the same way right now, and that therefore a legislative council which had popular support and therefore had a derived legitimacy from elections, that they would have then the authority to reinterpret that relation in the context of modern conditions. And I think also it's very interesting that they didn't insist on sort of legislators being clergy. For them, and they said this repeatedly in many different interviews, the authority comes from being elected, not from having religious knowledge. So I think that is a key difference with ISIS, which doesn't accept democracy, which has applied Sharia law without much sort of reinterpretation. Certainly, without consulting with sort of the wider population. Hamas has, of course, has run in elections. I mean, even before it was Hamas, as the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, they ran in student elections, in elections of professional syndicates. During the 90s, they won most of those, and Fatah sort of lost in those, because a lot of those unions were very critical of the Oslo Accords and felt that Fatah had sold them out. And then, of course, when Hamas boycotted the 1996 first Palestinian national elections, because it argued at the time that this was a product of a flawed peace accord of the Oslo peace accord, and that they didn't think it had popular legitimacy. And it's very interesting. They critiqued Arafat and Fatah and the PLO for accepting this peace agreement without consulting the population, but without having a referendum. So they used sort of democratic logic to say that this peace agreement doesn't have any standing, and then they come to boycott the elections as on the back of that. By 2006, it was clear that the Oslo Accord was dead. I mean, that was when the Al-Aqsa Intifada broke out. That was more or less sort of the end of it. So the elections, although it was actually still in the framework of working towards a two-state solution, they were acceptable to Hamas, and then Hamas then participated and played the rules of the electoral game. And I think that, again, is very different from what you expect ISIS to do. And I think also just the whole attitude that Hamas has to ideological difference, that's certainly for various periods of its life, it has allied itself with ideological opponents. For example, during the 90s, it was allied with the Marxist Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, because they were both opposed to the peace process. So Hamas hasn't gone for this sort of takfiri idea of ISIS, that anybody that ISIS considers not a sort of a pure Muslim needs to be executed. It hasn't gone down that route. That's not to say, of course, that Hamas hasn't used violence to coerce opponents into consent. I mean, since it has been ruling in Gaza, it has been very harsh on political criticism. So that runs very much counter to their whole sort of ethos that they developed in the 90s and 2000s. But I think that also has to be seen in the context of the way it came to power and then how it was treated, because once it had won the elections, it was boycotted both by international community and by Fatah itself. And then with the kind of the intelligence and the rumors about a coup against it, so that Fatah apparently supported by the international community and key actors like the United States to violently remove Hamas, because the international community didn't agree with the electoral will of the Palestinians. That then also immediately sets the tone for a very mistrustful relationship between Hamas and Fatah. And so I think a lot of the coercion that had then happened since then was in part driven by this fear that if there were any political opposition, Fatah and the international community would exploit that, which is not to justify it, just to try and sort of put some context around that.
Yeah. I'd like to go deeper into that because, you know, you outlined how the group had essentially developed a kind of political theory within the spectrum of Islamist movements. You know, as it's governed Gaza since the 2006 elections, it's taken on a more authoritarian turn. And so that's a clear departure from its political theory. And so I'm wondering, many political theorists argue that involvement in electoral politics moderates armed groups. I'm wondering as to whether the case of Hamas and Gaza is a useful test of that that theory because, you know, the occupation continues. There is there have been international actors that have sought to sort of subvert Hamas's initial electoral mandate. So is that the appropriate way to look at the question of how Hamas has changed or governed since 2006? Is the issue, you know, that Hamas has taken an authoritarian turn, or are we missing some of the exogenous factors and the type of environment that it operates in?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, it's a very complex question. I think you can see parts of sort of a moderating influence of being in government. And I've alluded to these various periods when Hamas sought to negotiate a national unity government with Fatah, where Hamas leaders compromised on their position, because their original position of course was the establishment of an Islamic State in all of historic British mandate Palestine, and they departed from that only when they started to engage in national elections and were serving government. When increasingly the political wing was putting out statements that it would accept effectively a two-state solution. So I think that's kind of, if moderation is the right word, I think moderation is a very loaded word, because and it's also very unclear as to who's moderating towards what. And it's more that I think when groups become part of government, they could sort of absorb the dominant norms of that government, and whether those norms are democratic or authoritarian in some ways, I think that's the second question. But if we use the word moderation, I think the turn towards accepting a two-state solution is unlikely to have happened if Hamas had not been forced to engage in national elections and consider government. Similarly, I don't think Hamas would have taken up the role of policing the border with Israel and clamping down on other more militant resistance groups within Gaza, which it has done for extended periods of time, where it has kept the calm on the border with Israel. Again, it wouldn't have done that if it had not been in government. It wouldn't have made all kind of compromises in terms of how to run a civil service. So there are elements of this kind of becoming adapted to being governed. But I think there are some very important counterbalances. You mentioned that the occupation didn't end, and I think you have to see Hamas as being engaged in an anti-colonial struggle, where the colonial power is still occupying its territory. So there is this asymmetry. There's the continuing sort of reasons for Hamas's turn to violence, which is occupation, which is the displacement of people, which is the constant humiliation, the de-development of Gaza, the lack of economic opportunities. All that is still there, and that feeds still to the reason why Hamas would turn to violence, and why also there's still a fairly broad support among the population for a return to armed struggle. I mean, in Gaza, for example, at the moment, that's at least before this conflict, about 50% of people in surveys said that they were for a return to armed struggle, and the belief that armed struggle in the past has led to, for example, the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza in 2005. Well, of course, the picture there is more complicated. And I think, but the other thing is that a lot of the mechanisms that political science would point to as having a moderating effect are just not there. So for example, one thing is that if you become part of a government which has a strong sort of civil service ethos, which already has been well established, that then sort of a party coming into government would be both socialized into those norms, but also then take on the interests of that civil service. And if that would veer towards a more kind of peaceful behavior, then that would be expected. Here, the civil service was already sort of destroyed from the very beginning when Hamas took over government, because Fatah boycotted Hamas and basically made governing impossible. So there was no sort of strong government culture to be socialized into. The wheeling and dealing and the having to make compromises in any kind of in a parliamentary setting, that wasn't really there. I mean, there have been sort of those attempts at national unity government, but these were very fraught negotiations mediated by Egypt, which for most of the time was on the side of Fatah and didn't want Hamas to succeed. So it wasn't an even playing field on that side. And that's very different from having sort of a parliament where you have different factions that you need to make alliances with. And so that kind of moderating mechanism wasn't there either. And then there haven't been elections since then. And elections, again, can have a moderating effect if the general population has more moderate views. And so there's two elements here. That first, there haven't been elections that Hamas had to act towards. I mean, they have to take into account what public opinion is in a very kind of systematic way. It's not just looking at the public opinion poll and then sort of being able to half ignore that, because you actually need to get people's votes. That hasn't been there. But also, because the occupation has been ongoing, because there isn't a two-state solution yet, because the conflict hasn't been resolved, there's still a very significant sector of the population that supports Hamas's views and the militancy. And so even if there were elections, that isn't a kind of mechanism to moderate, because what some people call an insurgent society, a society that is radicalized by years of occupation, is not going to put the same kind of moderating brakes on the party in government. So I think in that sense, that kind of analysis doesn't work in this case, because there are so many counterfactors that stop Hamas from moderating. And in some ways, the fact that it has at times shown sort of political overtures and tried to kind of to have these national unity governments, even conceded to Fatah, putting security forces on the Gazan border with Egypt, all these sort of compromises in order to try and lift the blockade, shows that there were some pressures towards moderation. But then I think, again, because the international community didn't respond to any of these overtures, because Israel didn't respond, then, of course, those lose their power. And so those wanting to compromise also lose the will to do this, because there's no kind of incentive to continue going when every time you do make an overture, there's just no response to that.
There's no incentive, and the environment itself is militarized, and its main opponent within the spectrum of Palestinian politics is also an authoritarian actor.
Yeah.
The Palestinian Authority and Fatah. In many ways, it takes two to tango, I would say, to democratize a polarized society. Now, you talk about some of those compromises, and one of those is the 2017 charter issued by Hamas. And I'd like you to talk about the significance of the language of that charter as compared to the 1987 charter, and what that says about the group and its internal workings and the different factions within, and its willingness to adopt what, let's say, the consensus of the international community sees as a desired end state in terms of a two-state solution.
The first thing to say there is that a lot of terrorism scholars ignore this new manifesto, and they keep going back to the original charter from 1988 as if that is the essence of Hamas. And I think it's important to emphasize that even in the 1990s, when I was talking to rank and file Hamas members as well as Hamas leaders, a lot of them didn't agree with the charter already then. They felt it was written by an older generation of Palestinian Muslim brothers. It didn't represent the views of the younger generation that had become involved in Hamas during the first Intifada and then afterwards in the 1990s. A lot of people had never read it. So when people, when scholars keep going back to it and saying, well, this is what Hamas believes, I would already contest that's just the fact that a few leaders wrote that in 1988 doesn't necessarily mean that represents the views of all Hamas. It's not to say that there aren't factions within Hamas who would still subscribe to some of those views, but I think it is much more complicated than that. And I think the other thing which is very significant about 2017 manifesto, and this also tells you something about the internal sort of organizational culture within Hamas, is that for a long time, Hamas had been talking about creating a new manifesto, because they realized that the charter from 1988 didn't help them politically, that it painted them as a sort of intransigent sort of deeply anti-Semitic force because of the sort of the language that they used. So they wanted him to get away from that. And there was already talk about it for years, I mean, decades, even before the actual new manifesto came out. And I think one of the reasons why they didn't do this earlier was that there was a sense that they didn't want to betray the earlier generation of leaders. And there's a sense of respect for authority, but also respect for elders. And because it was the older leadership that had written that manifesto at the time, the younger leadership didn't want to come to disrespect it, even though they didn't agree with it. And I think that's an interesting kind of observation. So when it did come out in 2017, it must have had the consent from the Shura Council, because otherwise it wouldn't have been allowed to be published. And so the language itself is important because it reflects a consensus of that Shura Council, the governing council of Hamas at that time. And it's interesting that there's a number of notable sort of differences. It is a much more secular document than the original. I mean, the original has a lot of Islamic connotations. It's still some of that is there, but it's much more reduced. It of course famously states that Hamas will accept a Palestinian state on the 96-7 borders because it is the national consensus. So that again is a reference to this democratic idea of legitimacy through popular support. Showing also the tensions within Hamas, even at the time, of course, it does not give up on other parts of its identity, which is that it did not recognize Israel. It stated in this document, and it did not want to give up the right of return to historic Palestinian land. And that's partly, I think, to appease the hardliners within Hamas. It's also partly a tactical maneuver because Hamas has for long sort of said that they didn't want to become like Fatah. And the way they understand Fatah is that Fatah, they kind of sold out on the Palestinian struggle in the 90s by signing a peace agreement with Israel, by recognizing the state of Israel, by giving up arms without first insisting on a Palestinian state. And so for Hamas, they come to the rationale, when you talk to leaders, it's very much, why would we recognize Israel, give up violence, etc., before we've been given what we demand as a minimum. After that, we can negotiate about that. And this is, I think, something also which the international quartet with the US, UN, EU, and Russia, which sort of oversaw the peace process and which issued these three demands of Hamas and said, we only will engage with Hamas if you recognize not just Israel, but the right of Israel to exist, which is a very high threshold because most countries do not accept the right of other countries to exist, and certainly most occupied people would not want to kind of accede to that. That Hamas would forever give up violence, which from Hamas' perspective, they say, why would we give up violence if that's the, from their thinking, that's the only thing that Israel listens to. You can debate whether that's true, but I mean, that's their kind of perspective. And then that they would have to accept all previous Palestinian agreements. And I think for all these points, Hamas would want to keep that as leverage in negotiations and not sort of concede to that before they are even engaged, because by that point there's no leverage left and then they fear there will be no Palestinian state. So I think that's important to kind of to put that into context. And then the final thing, and I think this is important, is that in that document, Hamas clarified that its struggle was with Zionists and not with Jews. And so this doesn't mean that within Hamas writ large, there aren't still leaders who make statements that can be confused to and sort of say that there's a struggle with the Jews, and they still repeat anti-Semitic tropes. But I think it's interesting that in this formal document, that language has been removed. And this is in some ways a product of international engagement. I wrote an article on this, looking at the role of Swiss governments after the boycott of Hamas in 2006, because the Swiss didn't agree with the international boycott and they continued to engage with Hamas. And their ministers various ministries, they convinced the Hamas leadership at the time, for example, that having a link to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is an anti-Semitic document, on Hamas's website was not acceptable to the international community, and that Hamas needed to clarify where it stood on this position. So I think it's interesting that Hamas responded to that international engagement, and particularly interesting also in the light of what Tony Blair, was the envoy of the Middle East quartet, said recently, that he realized now it was a mistake to boycott Hamas in 2006, because had the international community accepted elections and then engaged Hamas, that would have been an opportunity for the international community to pressure Hamas on the points that the international community disagreed with, because then there would be a leverage that the international community had over Hamas, which otherwise they don't have.
Yeah, it seems like a missed opportunity. Now, what is striking for me is that when you look at Hamas as a political actor, it is very much a Palestinian organization, as opposed to simply just an Islamist or a quote-unquote jihadist organization. And when we use these sort of transnational labels, I think we often just lose sight of how this organization is responsive, operates within the spectrum of Palestinian politics, within Palestinian society, and is responsive, has to be responsive to their needs at the time. So during the 2006 elections, the Hamas electoralists ran under the change and reform list. So this was kind of like a type of label that one would see from, you know, more pragmatic Islamic origin parties like Rafah and the AKP in Turkey. It just seemed, and then when you look at, you know, public opinion at the time, the most important concerns for Palestinians were corruption, the occupation, poverty, and unemployment. So the occupation, but also quality of life and governance issues. And so the way they framed their campaign was very much in line with the demands of the public at the time. And one interesting note in your book is that you may have noted it at least on one occasion, is that they conducted surveys before the elections. So they wanted to get a sense of what was the pulse on the ground and shape their campaign according to that. So I found that to be very interesting, because we kind of just look at the organization as a bunch of guys with arms and suicide bombers. But there is at least at one point when there was an opportunity for a democratic opening, they took advantage of it, and they approached it in very much like a pragmatic political party. Now, you know, I want to address the question of the supposed goal of Israel and the United States to dismantle Hamas. In your view, is that realistic? And how deep is the party's support in Gaza right now?
I think, judging by history, it is highly unrealistic. I mean, if you look at governments trying to eradicate an indigenous organization with grassroots support, particularly if it's a colonial government fighting an anti-colonial movement, it has not been possible unless the government opts for a full-scale genocide. Desperately hope that's not gonna happen. I mean, already the number of people killed in the last 3 weeks is more than the number of number of Palestinians killed in the last few weeks. It is more than the total number of Palestinians killed between 2008 and 2023. So we're already kind of inching towards that. But just to kind of to think about this hypothetically, I mean, we don't know how many fighters have been killed by Israel, but we do know the figures that come out of Gaza, which the World Health Organization and the UN trusts, that the vast majority of those killed in the bombardments of Gaza of the past few weeks were civilians, and almost half of them children. Only as a small percentage of the people killed would be actually fighters from the Qassam Brigade. So if we assume, say, a rough figure of say 10% of those killed were Qassam fighters, and if this ratio would hold throughout the fighting, then Israel would be killing roughly 400,000 civilians to kill all of the brigade's reported 40,000 fighters. And that's not even starting with the political leadership and the social welfare wing, or even turn to the side, who is a member of Hamas? Because you've got this organization which runs a government. There will be civil servants, some of them more signed up to Hamas, others less signed up. There are people running charities, which most of the charities are not directly linked to Hamas, but have Hamas members on their board, but also non-Hamas members. If Israel is serious about eradicating all of those people, it will be a complete bloodbath. And I would hope that the international community would actually come to its senses and put pressure on Israel to stop before that happens, because that would be the end of Gaza. And I think the other element sort of to think about is that when a vastly superior power in terms of technology and how many people they can mobilize, when they bomb places like Gaza, and sort of the sense that response far outweighs the original reason for the fighting in terms of how Gazans are seeing this. What happens then is, even though many Gazans will be critical of Hamas for triggering this harsh response in the first place, the devastation that Israel has meted out, and its total siege of Gaza, its starving of the population, its disregard for civilian death, its rhetoric about Gaza, talking about human animals and wiping out Gaza, means that this turns Gazans against Israel and sort of mobilizes them behind Hamas, which is the only sort of big actor among the Palestinian factions that stands up to Israel. So in some ways, the way Israel is going about its response to Hamas is likely to radicalize public opinion, because people will blame Israel for this vast disproportionate response. And then I think the other thing that's important to see is that Hamas has continued to have a broad support base throughout the time it has ruled. In a recent survey in September, when Gazans were asked who they would vote for in national elections if they were tomorrow, over 40% of Gazans said they would still vote for Hamas, and about 30% for Fatah. And I think this is partly because Hamas is seen as a resistance party that will not give up on the kind of the goal of a two-state solution, and it stands up to Israeli occupation. But it's also because it provides social welfare. It has in the past improved government services. I mean, when it took over from Fatah, and particularly after 2007, when it could actually run the government in Gaza, so unopposed by Fatah, it did improve government services, and a lot of people on the ground seem to be positive about that. Things have changed in the sense that now 75% of Gazans in this September survey believe that the Hamas government is corrupt. Incidentally, the same figure as people believe in the West Bank about the Palestinian Authority. It has, of course, become very autocratic, not allowing for political dissent. And yet it continues to endure support, in some ways because of lack of alternatives and because of the ongoing occupation. And then I think what's also interesting and something that Israel doesn't seem to learn from is that every time there's this war on Gaza with a bombardment which kills many civilians, support for Hamas increases afterwards. There's a rallying around the flag, a sense of popular anger, which then gets translated into support for Hamas. So it doesn't actually reduce support for Hamas. From my perspective, unless Israel succeeds against history and sort of the expectations in eradicating Hamas, at some point it will have to negotiate with Hamas. There have already been negotiations with Hamas around the hostages, and it's interesting that particularly the first hostages, which were mediated through Qatar, which where of course the political bureau, many members of Hamas's political bureau sit, suggest that the political leadership still has a role in what's happening. But also every war on Gaza has ended through indirect negotiations between Hamas and Israel, and a number of high-profile Israeli leaders, I mean, former heads of the Mossad, the intelligence arm of the Israeli state, former military commanders, have said there is no military solution to the Palestine conflict. There's no military solution to Gaza. Therefore, there has to be a political solution. And thinking, whether it's in Israel or in the international community, that you can just sit down with Fatah, which has lost so much credibility in many Palestinian eyes because of its functioning as the police agent of Israel. I mean, particularly starkly in the last couple of weeks, the Palestinian Authority very harshly clamped down on protesters in the West Bank who were protesting because of events in Gaza, because of the bombing of the Al Ahli hospital, for example. That just it shows to Palestinians that this is not a pro-Palestinian authority. But the idea that you would sit down only with them to try and negotiate some bottom-down peace deal, it hasn't worked in the past, and it will not work in the future. You have to also deal with the hardliners and with sort of the people who are still part of this of the resistance in Palestinian society. However unpopular that might be at the moment, and however Israel and the international community might be saying that Hamas has put itself beyond the political realm by the actions of October 7th, that doesn't change the reality that Hamas is still a powerful actor and an important actor that needs to be and engaged. And it's interesting when the United Kingdom decided to designate all of Hamas a terrorist organization a few years back, it was the Palestinian Authority who criticized the United Kingdom by saying that this would hinder achieving a two-state solution, because a two-state solution in their mind would only be possible through national reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah. And by designating all of Hamas, including its political wing, a terrorist organization, it hindered this national unity government idea. And I think that tells you something about Fatah's own understanding of its weakness within the Palestinian struggle. Of course, it's still an important player, but in some ways it needs Hamas in order to be able to deliver a two-state solution, particularly as there will have to be very difficult decisions to be made when it comes to final status negotiations. Of course, this is all in the context of having had the most right-wing government in Israel's history, politicians who are not at all interested in the Palestinian state, parties in government that have not accepted the two-state solution as an option. I mean, people push Hamas into that direction. It would be good for the international community to push Israeli parties to accept the two-state solution before they enter government. But of course, that's not the way the international community works at the moment.
Right. And, you know, it takes two to tango to make a peace agreement. Now, when we look at the issue of legitimacy, a public opinion polls show that the current leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, as public support is near rock bottom. And I think when you look at the polls in terms of potential presidential elections, they show that Palestinian society is divided, but the occupation remains kind of the center of gravity, the central issue. So in a three-way race, the leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, he comes second, and then Marwan Barghouti, who's an imprisoned member of Fatah and more of a popular leader, comes out first. And so these two combined get over 50% of the vote. And these are organizations that are seen as playing the role of resistance, as opposed to the Palestinian Authority, which is very much seen as a subcontractor for Israeli security. So I think we look at the big picture. Legitimacy matters, and the occupation is a reality for ordinary Palestinians. Now, the final question, I want to get to the broader issue of violence, because the beginning of the show, we talked about how there is an absence of language to describe excessive violence, immoral violence, unethical violence by state actors. So we have the label terrorism, which is generally applied to non-state actors in their use of violence against civilians and non-combatants for political aims. There really isn't a similar label for state actors. And I think especially in this kind of struggle where there are non-state actors, proto-state actors, and then a fully developed state with nuclear arms and one of the most powerful military in the Middle East, and that disparity in terms of one, a capability, but also in terms of how we apply moral language to their behavior is really clear. So I'd like to conclude by giving you the opportunity to talk a bit about how we should look at the question of violence in this conflict for passive viewers, because people only pay attention, I think, when there's a large-scale attack targeting Israelis, and then that's when the world media and the international community pays attention. But violence is very much part of the background noise in the Palestinian areas, in the West Bank and Gaza. It's a daily affair. And so I'd like you to talk about the question of violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and what type of assumptions we have in how we talk about state actors and non-state actors, and what's a better way to approach this.
Well, I think you've put your finger on the kind of the asymmetry of this. That the word terrorism is used for non-state actors. It's used to kind of to depoliticize what's happening and just to criminalize what's happening. And I mean, this is to start by saying what Hamas did on October 7 is, in my view, a war crime on many levels. And I can completely condemn it. But what's interesting is that when people are asked about this, there's kind of an assumption in international media that you have to start by condemning Hamas's violence, there's not the same assumption that you have to start by condemning Israel's violence. And that already kind of speaks to that asymmetry. And I think this is where I mean, one of the reasons I became one of the co-founders of the field of critical terrorism studies was that I felt this term terrorism is a political strategy to exclude non-state actors that use violence from political solutions, because once it gets used and invoked, it means that you can't negotiate with them. It means that political solutions are no longer on the table, only military solutions. It means that the way people think about it is how do we decapitate this movement? How do we kill the leaders? Not how do we change the kind of opportunity structure to make nonviolence or political overtures more advantageous than violent overtures. And particularly because it's hardly ever used to describe state violence, you then get this fundamental imbalance as to how the actors are treated. In this particular case, I think it makes much more sense to think of this as an anti-colonial movement fighting a colonial power. And if you look at it historically, anti-colonial movements have, on the whole, been very violent. Why? Because colonial powers do not tend to give up their power unless they are forced to. And that often means something incurring death that they want to avoid, however unfortunate that is. But that seems to be the kind of story that history is telling us. But also, I think by just looking at the violence, you overlook the structural violence that's happening. And settler colonialism, occupation, involve a lot of structural violence that sort of is not as visible. And this is the sort of, if you think about people who are born in Gaza in the early 2000s, they've never been outside of Gaza. So think about living in a piece of land that's 10 kilometers by 40 kilometers, and that's all you experience. And then within your life of, let's say, the last, you're now, say 20, you will have experienced multiple wars on Gaza where you have lost family members. That, I mean, that's the sort of direct violence. But then the indirect violence, the structural violence that comes from that, is the sort of the blockade that then is imposed, which means that houses don't get rebuilt. It means that the economy can't grow, and there's despair. I mean, the number of Gazans that I've met who have the degrees in sort of engineering or speech therapy, or who have no jobs because there is no economy for that. They can't go outside to find jobs because they're stuck. It's the kind of the structural violence of, for example, the father of a friend of mine died of a heart attack as he came back from an operation in Jerusalem. Only allowed to go on his own. He was in his 80s and was very frail. His sons wanted to go with him, but because they were profiled that they might be considered suicide bombers, they were not allowed to accompany him to the hospital. As he returned and he was walking in the baking heat between the Israeli part of the checkpoint into Gaza at Erez and the Palestinian part, he died alone, on his own. Those kind of humiliations, those kind of the pain and the suffering, that it gets erased when you take to the label of terrorism. And I think the reason why there is such support for armed struggle, why occupation still matters, as well as the economy, etc., is that the whole of life gets warped by this. And it's I mean, starting with sort of the displacement in 1948. I mean, if you look at of the over 700,000 Palestinians that were ethnically cleansed from historic Palestine, a large percentage ended up in Gaza, tripling the population almost overnight, and up to today, over 70% of the Gazan population are refugees from what is now Israel, or the descendants of those refugees. And so, for example, Gazans, when they're asked, where are you from? They say, well, we're from this village in historic Palestine, not from this camp in Gaza. So that's already kind of a structural violence to your identity, to your history, to not being able to go and visit the graves of your parents or your grandparents. That all gets erased from this. And I think it's the very brutality of colonial powers, of settler colonialism, for example, in the West Bank, the constant expansion of settler colonies, the attacks by settlers on civilians that are daily, often supported, or at least condoned by the Israeli army. those kind of things get erased when you look at it through a terrorism lens. And I think that's why it's much more useful to use the anti-colonial lens. I would also say, in terms of going forward, a much more even-handed approach would be to say, take both or all actors in this conflict to the International Criminal Court. Now that Palestine is a signatory to this court, everything that happens in Gaza is part of the remit of that court. Israel, of course, is not. It has refused to sign up to that. But what I would suggest is take the Israeli government as well as Hamas to the International Criminal Court and try them for the war crimes that were committed, punish those who are responsible. That then creates disincentives for this kind of violence, but in an equal way and not in an unequal way. And it also, it keeps the political option open, because it then doesn't sort of criminalize the entirety of a group like Hamas. It means that you can still have negotiations with the political wing. It also means that there is the possibility to put pressure on the movement. For example, in this particular conflict, when foreign heads of state visit Israel, they might at the stretch also visit Ramallah and meet with President Abbas. They're not going to visit with Hamas. But that actually means that you cannot also put pressure on Hamas in that more direct way. So actually, the international community is hindering itself from finding a solution.
Yeah. And I think, you know, your call for using sort of international institutions to hold both sides accountable for their crimes against innocent human beings, it reflects the potential to use the so-called rules-based order that President Biden and others mention often when in these sorts of geopolitical events, but they're very much reluctant to apply to their own selves as well as to their allies. So there's an asymmetry in terms of power, but also accountability. And, you know, true justice for all peoples requires a kind of neutrality and even-handedness in terms of how that's applied. And that the absence of that is a major reason why this conflict continues to fester. So, Yaron, thank you for joining us. That was deeply informative. And I think our conversation provided a really useful corrective in terms of the broader discourse about the events that's happening in both Israel and Palestine. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that was Yaron Gunning of King's College London. We're going to be continuing with our focus on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis in our upcoming episodes. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice, and thank you for tuning in.